Finley Campbell was there with his wife, as required. Neither of them were particularly happy about it. They'd had a blazing row on their wedding day, and things had gone rapidly downhill ever since. They'd only agreed to the arranged marriage under the greatest of pressures, and a few not terribly discreet threats. They would have had each other assassinated long ago if they could only figure out how to get away with it, but the Imperial Espers had taken all the fun out of interfamily murder. So the marriage continued under protest. In the meantime, they kept as far apart as possible, and met only on formal occasions that demanded their presence, like this one. The only things they had in common were their two children, 5 and 6 years old, respectively, already holy terrors by all accounts. The product of laboratory conceptions and births, they spent their early years under family-approved nannies and were currently attending family-approved boarding schools. Strong clan loyalty was made, not born, and the family believed in starting early. They also didn't want to risk any interference from the parents. Finley often thought wistfully of his son and daughter. He enjoyed their company when he could, and had a feeling he might have made a good father for them, given the chance. But as in so many other things these days, it was not allowed. Finley sighed quietly and looked around him, hoping for diversion, if not inspiration. He himself was the height of fashion, as always, from his shocking pink cutaway coat to his fluorescent face and shoulder-length metallicized hair of burning bronze. His cravat was midnight blue silk, fashionably badly tied to show one did it oneself. His velvet cap was jet black with a single peacock's feather, and he regarded the scene through a pair of jeweled pince-nez spectacles he didn't need, but which added just the right touch. He also carried a sword on his hip, as custom required, but though the hilt and scabbard were crusted with precious stones, only Finley knew the blade in the scabbard was perfectly serviceable, and not in the least ornamental. The wedding was due to take place in half an hour, and the ballroom was crowded. One voice still rose above the general din, and without looking round, Finley knew it had to be his wife, Adrienne. She had one of those laser beam voices that can cut through anything. Not for the first time, Finley thought, if the family could just find some way of harnessing it as a weapon, they'd make a fortune. He turned slowly, resignedly, and sure enough, there was Adrienne holding court before a group of minor nobles' wives, who looked like they'd rather be somewhere else. Anywhere else. Adrienne was of average height and just a little more than average weight, but made her presence known by being the loudest, both visually and audibly, person in any gathering. She wore a long black gown, partly because she thought the color suited her pale skin, but mostly because that way she could claim to be in mourning for her marriage. It was as far off the shoulder as she could get it without actually having it fall around her knees, and it was split up the sides as far as her hips. It looked like it would take one good sneeze for it to fall off. She had a sharp face, all planes and angles and angry scarlet mouth. Her eyes were narrow and perhaps just a little too close together, and she had the smallest, most upturned nose that money could buy. She had a mop of curly hair, shining bright gold like a distress beacon. Her movements were sudden and abrupt, like a striking bird, and she treated each conversation as an enemy to be dominated and brought to heel. It was possible she might have heard of tact somewhere, but if she had, she'd never been seen to bother with it. If she'd been a man, her mouth would have bought her 100 duels. As it was, there were those who suggested broadening the term man to include Adrienne Campbell on general principles. She had a large drink in her hand, from which she took large gulps in between hectoring her audience, and God help the servants if they weren't there to refill her glass when she needed it. She looked about the magnificent ballroom and shook her head disgustedly.
God, this place is a dump! I've seen livelier funerals and better catered. I'd pour this wine down the toilet, but I'd swear someone already beat me to it. And would you look at the groom? I've seen men being prematurely buried who look happier than he does. And the bride, she's a child. Probably have to give her wedding night a miss so she can finish her homework. I take it someone has taken her to one side and filled her in on the facts of life. Like, one, always use a contraceptive, and two, always get it in writing and preferably witnessed. Look at her. Poor thing, looks as confused as a blind lesbian in a fish market. Still, a good young maiden of tap water she's marrying.
Adrienne went on like that for some time, pausing only when she absolutely had to breathe or drink or glare at someone who didn't look like they were listening to her intently enough. Finlay watched admiringly, from a distance. He appreciated a good performance, and Adrienne was certainly on form this afternoon. Mind you, after enduring several years of such verbal battery at close range, he'd acquired a certain immunity. Others were not so fortunate. More than one of the ladies in Adrian's current audience looked as though they were thinking wistfully how easy it would be to drop something really unpleasant but not necessarily actually fatal in Adrian's drink when she wasn't looking. Finlay completely understood the impulse. Adrian's voice had the carrying quality of an airstrike and was usually about as welcome. People arranging parties and other social gatherings had been known to get extremely inventive when it came to producing reasons why Adrienne shouldn't attend, everything from outbreaks of plague to social unrest, but it didn't make any difference. Adrienne turned up anyway. As a Campbell by marriage, she couldn't be excluded, and she had very thick skin. And it had to be said, the more attention they paid to her, the less they paid to Finlay Campbell, which wasn't always a bad thing. He gazed about the crowded ballroom, packed with all the bright flowers of the aristocracy going through the familiar ritual dances of intrigue and seduction, politics and gossip. Finlay despised them all. They knew nothing of courage or the true extremes of life and death, except in their carefully orchestrated code duello, where honor was often satisfied with first blood. Finlay watched them all with an empty smile on his face and contempt in his heart. He looked desperately about him in search of diversion, and his gaze lighted on the wolves. The wolf himself was absent, along with his new wife, a courtesy so that whatever happened they could officially ignore any behavior that might threaten the neutrality of the occasion. But Valentine, Stephanie, and Daniel were there, looking as though they'd much rather be somewhere else. Finlay smiled slightly. Of course, all three of them had arranged marriages of their own, coming up in the very near future. Presumably, their father had insisted they attend to gain a few pointers on the terrible fate that awaited them. Stephanie and Daniel were standing together, ostentatiously ignoring their respective betrothed, who were currently chatting amiably with each other and getting on like a house on fire. Valentine stood alone, as always, tall and slender and darkly delicate, wearing a plum-colored coat and leggings. With his long, dark curly hair and painted face, he looked like nothing so much as a rich but bruised fruit from some unhealthy tree. Beyond the mascaraed eyes and wide crimson smile, his face seemed polite but partly absent, as though his thoughts were somewhere else. Finlay didn't like to think where that might be. Valentine had no wine glass in his hand, presumably because there wasn't a wine in the room potent enough to jolt his jaded appetites. Finlay decided he'd better find someone to talk to before someone really boring settled on him, and the wolves looked as interesting as any. Besides, Valentine intrigued him. They'd both attended the same school at the same time, but that was pretty much all they had in common, then and now. As far as Finlay could remember, Valentine had been a normal enough child, with no hint of warning of what he was to become. But then, that was probably true of him, too. He strode casually over to the wolves, as though he just happened to be drifting in their direction, nodding and smiling to those he passed, every movement the epitome of grace. He stopped before Valentine and bowed with a flourish. The wolf heir nodded courteously in return, the heavy black eye makeup and scarlet mouth standing out starkly against his pale skin. That particular look hadn't been fashionable in years, but having found something that appealed to his inner nature, Valentine was apparently loath to change it. Finlay wondered, with a sudden flash of insight, whether the painted face might be as much a mask as the one he wore. And if so, what other, stranger Valentine might lie behind it? A disturbing thought. Whatever lay behind the mask, it would have to be pretty damned strange to outdo his everyday persona. Finlay smiled dazzlingly.
You're looking very yourself, Valentine. I must say, I'm always surprised to see you actually up and about these days. Of course, if you were taking half the things you're supposed to be taking, I'd expect you to be wheeled in on a stretcher with a drip in your arm and tubes up your nose.
I try to maintain a careful balance between my inner and outer worlds. I see my condition as a continuing work of art, with drugs the colors of my palette. And every work of art must be seen by an audience to be truly appreciated. Not that most people understand or appreciate the effort and hard work involved in an ongoing performance.
I do understand. No one appreciates the sheer effort involved in being at the cutting edge of fashion. But you seem to be thriving on the pressure, Valentine. Perhaps you could give me the name of your chemist.
Valentine studied him silently for a moment, his face entirely expressionless, and Finley wondered what he'd said. Something had thrown the wolf air off balance. Finley decided to change the subject, whatever it was, rather than have it pursue some end he wasn't sure he wanted to reach.
I understand your wedding is scheduled to take place soon, Valentine. Any help I can offer, having been through the ghastly business myself?
Why, thank you, Finley, but I think I have everything under control. The flowers have been ordered, the bridesmaids chosen, and I've designed a rather special fruit punch for the occasion that should open a few eyes. I myself shall be wearing white, with a veil, and perhaps just a dash of belladonna for scent. I've taken care to inform my intended of this, so that our outfits won't clash.
I'm sure she was very appreciative of that.
The last I'd heard, she was offering quite a handsome reward for anyone willing to assassinate me. And if that doesn't work out, I understand she has professed a complete willingness and determination to do the job herself, with whatever weapons happen to be at hand on the wedding day. She is currently trying to stir up a vendetta between her family and mine, but since her parents helped arrange the match in the first place, due to the rather large dowry that comes with me, she's not getting very far.
Oh, she sounds very resolute.
Oh, yes, I do so admire a woman with spirit.
You must introduce me to her, Valentine, someday.
No sooner said than done. Here comes the lady now. Doesn't she look splendid?
Finley looked round sharply. A tall, gangling woman in her late 20s was advancing on them, wearing a bright scarlet gown with gold and silver trimmings to show off her perfect pale skin and naturally red hair. Finley had to wonder if perhaps the fashion for fluorescent skin and metallicized hair was over. Things change so fast nowadays. The young lady slowed to a halt before him and Valentine, quivering with suppressed emotion, her eyebrows sunk in a truly ferocious scowl. Her mouth was an angry straight line that spoke of barely controlled rage. Finley found his hand had dropped automatically to the sword on his hip. His instincts knew a genuine threat when they saw one. He bowed politely, and she shot him a look of undisguised venom. Finley felt a sudden urge to check how far he was from the nearest exit. She had the look of someone who threw things. Heavy things. Valentine seemed entirely unperturbed, and smiled courteously. "Finley Campbell, may I present Beatrice Christiana, soon to be my bride."
"Eat shit and die, clown, and you can put that hand away, because I have absolutely no intention of shaking it. I'd rather French kiss a leper than touch any part of you. With all the drugs boiling through what's left of your system, even your sweat's probably addictive. I received your latest communication. I think the veil is an excellent idea. May I also suggest a muzzle and a chastity belt, because you're not getting anywhere near me. I personally will be wearing a decontamination suit and carrying an electric cattle prod instead of a bouquet."
"I really must introduce you to my wife."
"Isn't she wonderful? I do like a woman with spunk. We were made for each other, Beatrice. Just think what our children will be like."
"You have a better chance of winning the church's annual Sobriety and Good Citizenship Award than you have of fathering a child on me, Valentine. I do not believe in laboratory fertilizations, and if you ever bring your disgusting parts anywhere near me, I will cram them into a blender. This is a political marriage only, Valentine. And now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to go and find something really fragile and expensive that I can throw at a wall."
She shot a brief glance at Finley.
"Do you have any idea what you look like? And I'd wipe that expression off your face, Finley Campbell, if I were you, or the wind might change and you'll be stuck that way."
And she stomped off, disappearing back into the crowd, which kept trying to get out of her way, but just weren't fast enough on their feet. Finley realized he was holding his breath, and let it out in a long sigh. He looked at Valentine, entirely lost for words, but the wolf air seemed unperturbed. He flicked an invisible fleck of dust from his cuff, and smiled at Finley.
"She'll come to appreciate my little ways. Eventually."
Not too far away, Evangeline Schreck, tall, slender, and positively waif-like in an off-the-shoulder gown, watched her beloved Finley talking with the notorious Valentine Wolf, and felt an almost overpowering urge to rush over and rescue him, or at least protect him. Valentine looked to her like nothing more than a corpse in a carnival mask, a harlequin in heat, all that was sick and corrupt in current society. But she couldn't even go near Finley without good cause. Even allowing for the imminent marriage that was to link the Campbells with the Shreks, there was still much bad feeling between the two houses. It was a miracle no one had thrown down a formal challenge yet. It would look odd at best, and suspicious at worst, if she were to just walk up to Finley and start chatting with him. Officially, they'd only ever met in passing on occasions like this. People would raise their eyebrows and make comments. They might even ask questions. Evangeline forced herself to look away, and there was her father standing beside her. She composed herself quickly and hoped her small involuntary start would be taken for surprise rather than guilt. Lord Gregor Shrek smiled at her fondly and patted her on the arm with his chubby hand. The Shrek was a short, round butterball of a man, all bulging flesh and deep-set eyes, with a constant, quietly unnerving smile. It amused him to indulge himself, and he cared nothing for fashion, which in turn cared nothing for him. He was not a sociable man, and as a rule avoided all gatherings he wasn't absolutely obliged to attend. He had never been popular or courted, despite his high station and prestigious connections, and he didn't give a damn. He had other private concerns.
"Can I get you a drink, my dear? Something to eat, perhaps? You know how it worries me when you don't eat."
"I'm sure, Father. Thank you. I don't want anything."
The Shrek shook his head unhappily.
"You must keep your strength up, my dear, or you'll waste away to skin and bone. You want to look nice for your papa, don't you?"
The hand on her arm closed warningly tight, and she made herself smile and nod. It wasn't wise to make him angry. For all his surface jollity, the Shrek had a foul temper and nasty, inventive malice. So she let him fuss over her and tried to remain as remote as she could without antagonizing him. It was a tightrope she'd gotten used to walking, but it never got any easier. The Shrek looked around at the noisily chattering crowd and scowled.
"Look at them. Happy as the day is long, and not a brain between them. Eating my food and drinking my wine. And my poor niece is still a brain-burned savage, a maid to the iron bitch. They're happy enough to stuff their faces at my expense, but not one of them would agree to support me in trying to get my niece back, no matter how I pleaded. They don't know how special to me she was, just like you, Evangeline. But I'll get her back somehow, and have my revenge on those who refused me."
And as quickly as that, the clouds left his pudgy face, and he let go of her arm. It throbbed dully, aching from the fierce grip, but she didn't dare rub at it. It wasn't wise to distract him when he was in one of his good moods.
"Still, I expect great things of this wedding. Dear Letitia makes a lovely bride, and Robert Campbell is supposed to be a fine, upstanding young man. I've never had much time for the Campbells, any of them. But it must be said they have good connections with interesting and important people. And with our two houses united by this marriage, those connections should drop right into my lap. In return, all we have to do is watch their backs and protect them from unexpected attacks, while they jockey for position over the mass production contracts for the new star drive, some of whose revenues will undoubtedly end up flowing in my direction. Things are looking up, Evangeline. Soon I'll be able to give you all the splendid presents I always wanted to. You've been very patient with me, listening to all my promises and never complaining. But once our ship comes in, You shall want for nothing, my dear, nothing at all. And all I ask in return is that you love me. Is that so much to ask?
No, Father.
Is it?
No, Father. You know I honor you as my father and show you all duty. My heart belongs to you.
Gregor Schreck smiled at her fondly.
Oh, you look more like your dear mother every day.
Evangeline was still trying to come up with a safe and neutral answer to that one when they were joined by James Kasser, the vicar of the Church of Christ the Warrior. Tall and muscular, and positively radiating physical superiority, the vicar looked very smart in his jet-black military surplice, and didn't he know it. The Empress had given the Church her official support when she ascended to the Iron Throne, and the Church in return supported her with all its vast political power. It had followers throughout the Empire, and was now the nearest thing the Empire had to an official Church. It named her Warden of the Stations of the Cross, Soldier of All Souls, and Defender of the Faith, and put its military training schools at her disposal. In practice, this meant the Church of Christ the Warrior had supplanted all other religions, in public at least, and its influence reached everywhere. The Empress excused the Church all taxes, allowed it to tithe its people as it wished, and used its Jesuit elite commandos to stamp out traitors in her name. So no one argued with the Church much. Not in public. James Kasser was a rising name in the Church. He distinguished himself as a Marine for several years, stamping out the Empire's enemies with unyielding determination, whatever the cost. He rose rapidly to Major, and then heard the call and transferred to the Church, where he turned his zeal to locating and persecuting all those who opposed the one true Church. And if in his enthusiasm he sometimes strayed outside the law or wiped out a few innocent bystanders along with the true targets, well, you can't make omelets and all that. He was a rising star, so no one said anything. Or at least, no one who mattered. It was a great honor for the Campbells and the Schrecks that he had agreed to officiate at this wedding, and he made sure everyone knew it. Lord Gregor bowed courteously to him, and Evangeline bobbed a curtsy.
Good of you to honor us with your presence, Your Grace. I trust all is to your satisfaction.
Then you trust wrong. Never seen so many degenerates and parasites in one room before. A spell in the services would put some backbone into them. Doubt half of them have seen the inside of a church since they were christened, or could recite the Catechism of the Warrior if pressed. But as long as the aristocracy still cuddles up to the Empress, long may she reign, they can afford to cock a snook at the Church. But that won't last forever.
Quite. May I offer you a glass of something?
Never touch this stuff. The body is a temple, and not to be defiled with noxious substances. I assume all the details for this wedding have been thoroughly checked out, Shrek. I have other engagements following this, and if I have to change my schedule, someone's going to suffer for it, and it isn't going to be me.
And that was when the wild-eyed zealot appeared with a crack of thunder in the middle of the ballroom, as though from nowhere. He wore only a ragged loincloth, and his bare skin was crisscrossed with old and recent scars. He wore a crown of thorns upon his brow, and blood ran down his face in sudden little rushes as his features moved. He had a starved, aesthetic look, and his eyes gleamed with the fire of the true fanatic and visionary. The stunned crowd started to react to his appearance, and then fell silent again as flames leapt up from nowhere, licking around the zealot without consuming him. He glared about him, and people shrank back, but when he spoke, his voice was surprisingly calm and even.
I am here to protest against the continuing slavery of espers and clones. I protest against the desecration of the one true Church of Christ the Redeemer. Christ was a man of peace and love, but if he were here now to see what you do in his name, he would turn his face away from us in despair. I do not fear your guards or interrogators. I have dedicated my life to the Lord, and I give it up now as a sign to you that espers and clones have a strength and faith of their own, and will not be denied.
He paused then, looked around him, and smiled slightly.
See you all in hell.
His body burst into flames, bright and searingly hot. Those nearest him fell back from the terrible heat, but in the heart of the flames, the zealot's smile never wavered, even as the fire consumed him. It was all over in a moment, and the flames and the heat died down to nothing. All that remained was a greasy stain on the floor, and a few ashes floating on the air, and a single discarded hand that had somehow fallen outside the devouring flames. It lay on the ballroom floor like a single pale flower, fingers outstretched as though in one last appeal for reason.
Esper scum. Saved us the trouble of executing him. Pyrokinetic, obviously. But how did he get in here? I was assured this ballroom was protected by S-blockers.
So it is.
Valentine Wolfe stepped forward.
I am not entirely certain what has happened, but as Senior Wolfe present, I can assure you that my security people are investigating the breach even as we speak.
That's not good enough, Wolf.
Kasser studied Valentine with undisguised contempt and disgust.
Whether he teleported in or was smuggled in, he must have had inside help. Which means you have a traitor here, Wolf. I'll detail a company of my men to help find him. They've had a lot of experience in finding traitors.
Thank you, but that won't be necessary. My people are quite capable of doing all that's required without disturbing my guests.
It took the wide-eyed guests a moment to realize that Valentine had just refused the vicar permission to bring his hard men in. This wasn't exactly unknown, but it was pretty damn rare. You upset the church at peril of your soul and your body these days. And James Kasser in particular wasn't used to being defied. His face reddened, and he stepped forward to glare right into Valentine's mascarad eyes.
Don't cross me, boy. I shed no tears for one more dead Esper. But I have no tolerance for traitors, no matter where they may be found. And high station is no protection against the will of the Lord.
How very reassuring.
Valentine said nothing more. The moment lengthened, and the tension grew. The vicar scowled at Valentine.
You look like a degenerate. Wipe that paint off your face.
Everyone stared at the two men, breathless in the spectacle of two legendary wills clashing. And then, Valentine took one more step forward, so that his face was right before Kasser's. His crimson smile widened, and his dark eyes didn't waver at all.
Lick it off.
Kasser looked at him, his mouth a tight white line. His hand hovered over his sword, but he didn't draw it. If he did, and killed the wolf heir in his own home, he would be committing the church to full vendetta against Clan Wolf. Rich and influential as it was, the wolves couldn't hope to stand against the full might of the church for long, but if the wolves did somehow win the contract for the new star drive, and the church had to come cap in hand to Clan Wolf for the new starships,